I want you to get up right now and go to the window and stick your head out and yell,
"Yo, Adrian, me rock."
She was an American girl.
It's the Muppet Show with our very special guest star,
Schlemiel, Schlemazel, Hasenbemp Incorporated.
Once upon a time, there were three little girls who went to the police academy.
We got them by the balls. Their hearts and minds will follow.
I'm gonna be a happy idiot.
The U.S. Supreme Court today ruled that the death penalty does not represent cruel and unusual punishment.
You're talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here.
Welcome to the Hotel California.
The first thing we're likely to see after Viking 1 touches down is Martian soil.
Trying to make some front page driving news.
200 years young. Let's do this again in 100 years.
Cliff, the U.S. celebrated its bicentennial in 1976, the year that we are profiling for this show. And I'm curious, do you think the United States, the longest-running democratic republic in world history, is going to make it to its tricentennial in 2076, only 52 years away from now?
Quite honestly, Ken, I don't know if the U.S. is going to make it to tomorrow, given the state of things, let alone 52 years from now.
It's a pretty grim outlook, Cliff, but don't get me wrong. I have definitely questioned our nation the last several years, but I'm going to remain optimistic.
Good for you.
Yeah, but then again, when I see the historical examples of 1976, I am truly concerned that we'll never learn and we are doomed to keep making the same mistakes over and over again. Now, I sound pretty damn grim, but the amazing thing about 1976 is the incredible pop culture that came out in that one year.
Welcome to Year View Mirror with Ken and Cliff. Ken and I are a couple of high school history teachers that discuss, debate, and deprecate each other's thoughts and ideas about U.S. history and popular culture. In each episode, we aim to create a big picture snapshot of one year in post-World War II America by using significant historical events to contextualize a handful of films, TV shows, and songs.
America's bicentennial was, of course, the big story that year, but the pop culture release that year was full of incredible quality and quantity of pop culture classics. We're in store for a little longer show than usual, but please stick with us. It's going to be a good one. We'll be discussing four outstanding movie debuts from 76, Rocky, Taxi Driver, Network, and All the President's Men.
For television, we'll be talking about the debuts of Laverne and Shirley, Charlie's Angels, and The Muppet Show. And for music, we have a lot to cover. We're discussing the music of The Eagles, Bob Seger, Jackson Browne, ABBA, The Sex Pistols, The Ramones, Stevie Wonder, Heart, and Tom Petty and The Heartbreakers.
I cannot wait to talk about the music.
But let's first talk about the most important stories of 1976.
Jimmy Carter was elected the 39th president of the United States in 76. Carter, a Democrat and former governor of Georgia, ran a grassroots campaign emphasizing honesty, integrity, and a fresh approach to politics. He positioned himself as a Washington outsider, promising to restore integrity to government following the Watergate scandal. Carter defeated incumbent President Gerald Ford, who had taken office after Richard Nixon's resignation in 1974, and who would later pardon Nixon for his alleged crimes.
There were two significant space program milestones in 1976. The very first space shuttle, the Enterprise, named after the Star Trek TV series vessel, flew its first mission that year. The other was the launch of the Viking 1 lander. The lander successfully touched down on the Martian surface in the summer of 1976, becoming the first spacecraft to land safely on Mars.
The United States Supreme Court made a significant decision regarding the death penalty in the case of Gregg versus Georgia. The court ruled that the death penalty was not inherently unconstitutional, reversing its previous 1972 decision in Furman versus Georgia, which had struck down existing penalty laws. This decision effectively reinstated capital punishment in the United States, allowing states to enact death penalty statutes that complied with the court's guidelines. As of 2024, there are 27 states in the United States with death penalty laws.
But the biggest story of 1976 was the United States Bicentennial, commemorating the 200th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Throughout the year, Americans celebrated with parades, exhibitions, and cultural programs across the country. Let's hear a short clip from then-President Gerald Ford's speech on July 4th, 1976.
The establishment of justice
and peace abroad will in large measure depend upon the peace and justice we create here in our own country, where we still show the way.
The irony of that speech is that Ford would lose the presidential election 4 months later for pretty much ignoring justice when he pardoned Richard Nixon, arguably one of the most corrupt presidents of all time, thereby preventing justice from enacting any consequences for Nixon's actions related to Watergate.
1976 was a landmark year for movies, showcasing a mix of commercially successful blockbusters and critically acclaimed films. All four of the movies that we've selected for this episode perfectly captured the zeitgeist of America in the 1970s. We're going to start with the number one box office film in 1976, Rocky.
Dun, 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 dun.
Written and starring Sylvester Stallone as Rocky Balboa, a poor, small-time boxer from Philadelphia who gets a shot at taking on the heavyweight champion at the time, Apollo Creed. Even though this was the number one box office film that year, the story of how a small budget movie about boxing starring a no-name actor became one of the most successful films of all time ironically parallels the rags-to-riches story of Rocky itself.
Sylvester Stallone had appeared in a number of small films and television shows in the late 60s and early 70s, but after watching a 1975 boxing match between then-boxing champion Muhammad Ali and no-name boxer Chuck Wepner, Stallone was inspired to write a screenplay of Rocky, which he then shopped around Hollywood to get made. Stallone refused to allow the film to be made without him in the lead role. United Artists Studio eventually agreed to cast Stallone after he rejected a six-figure deal for the film rights, thus assuring Stallone of significant royalties from all future Rocky films. And there have been five Rocky sequels and four Creed movies. The Creed movies follow the son of Apollo Creed and star Michael B. Jordan as Adonis Creed. Rocky received 10 Academy Award nominations and won 3, including Best Picture. It has been ranked by numerous publications as one of the greatest films of all time, as well as one of the most iconic sports films ever made. Let's hear a short clip from the film's original trailer.
Rocky, do you believe that America is the land of opportunity?
Yeah.
Apollo Creed does, and he's going to prove it to the whole world by giving an unknown a shot at the title.
Nobody's ever gone the distance from Creed. And if I can go that distance, seeing that bell rings and I'm still standing, that weren't just another bum from the neighborhood. I mean, who am I kidding? I ain't even in the guy's league. Wish me luck. I'm gonna need it.
Good luck.
Don't leave town.
So after watching this for the first time since seeing it in the theater in 1976, I was amazed how well it held up after almost 50 years. This is just a solid, great movie. And most of the credit for this movie's success has got to go to Sylvester Stallone. A relative nobody in the entertainment business, Stallone came up with a great story. He wrote a solid script. He starred in the film and ended up becoming one of Hollywood's most popular stars. But let's talk about two of the movie's most intriguing themes. And the American dream and race.
We've talked about the American dream a lot on this podcast. The American dream, of course, is an idea that has been around since the early 20th century. Quite simply, it embodies the idea of upward mobility and success achievable through hard work, determination, and initiative. It encompasses the notion that every individual, regardless of their background or social status, has the opportunity to achieve their goals and aspirations.
What I've always been amazed about the American dream is that there isn't any other country in the world that has a dream named after it. So in that respect, it is clearly and uniquely an American idea. But in regards to Rocky, there are several tenets of the American dream reflected in the story. The first one, of course, is the underdog narrative. Rocky works a menial job and struggles to make ends meet, very much like the majority of average Americans back then and today, especially immigrants and minorities. He gets a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to go against the champion. In the end, he may not have won the fight, but more importantly, it's his journey from a nobody to a somebody, that classic rags-to-riches story that resonates with viewers who may feel underestimated in their own life pursuits.
And lastly, while Rocky doesn't win the championship, he goes the full distance against a seemingly unbeatable opponent. This achievement earns him respect and national recognition, not to mention a slew of sequels over the next decades. The film suggests the American dream isn't solely about achieving ultimate victory, but also about exceeding expectations and proving oneself. Rocky's journey Journey emphasizes the value of perseverance and the personal growth achieved through striving for a goal.
The other theme of Rocky is somewhat related to the American Dream, and that's how the issue of race comes into play in achieving the American Dream. Any student of history already knows that white people were in control of America right from the start, that is, after they decimated the Native American population. However, white control started to decline soon after the civil rights movement of the mid-20th century, when legislative and court rulings started to level the playing field. Equal opportunities were becoming increasingly available to not only blacks, but to other minorities and women as well. Sports was one of the first areas where those opportunities became more accessible to blacks. Black athletes like Muhammad Ali, Arthur Ashe, Jim Brown, and Bill Russell became national and racial heroes. By 1976, black athletes were not necessarily dominating professional sports, but it was clear that white dominance was eroding. So when a white underdog boxer came along in a far-flung attempt to defeat the black champion, some saw Rocky as the great white hope, an avatar of the racial divide of the 1970s.
You know, Ken, this is the one aspect of the first Rocky film that bothers me. Not because I believe that Sylvester Stallone deliberately set out to create a movie that reflected racial tensions in America, but because it's pretty easy to see it that way, no matter what Stallone intended.
Yes.
But this reading, I contend, is all hogwash.
All right.
Sylvester Stallone, who insisted he play the film's title character, just happens to be white. Carl Weathers, who was casted to play the part of the champion Apollo Creed, just happened to have been black. Weathers recently passed away.
Yeah, I read about that.
That's it. In other words, white nationalists, you keep your filthy mitts off of this great film.
We move from a working class American hero to a working class American anti-hero. Taxi Driver is a neo-noir psychological drama directed by Martin Scorsese and written by Paul Schrader. Taxi Driver is ranked by the American Film Institute as the 52nd greatest American film on its top 100 list, and if you're curious, Cliff, it didn't even make my top 100. Taxi Driver is set in a decaying and morally bankrupt New York City following the Vietnam War. The film follows Travis Bickle, played by Robert De Niro, a war veteran and taxi driver, and his deteriorating mental state as he works nights in the city. I don't remember when I first saw this, but after seeing it the very first time, it convinced me Scorsese was a god. I eventually got over that and now consider Scorsese to be an important filmmaker, but a wildly inconsistent one. However, after rewatching Taxi Driver for this podcast, I actually think this movie not only held up well, I now think it's a landmark work in American cinema. It not only established Scorsese and De Niro as Hollywood icons, it was one of the better films from the new Hollywood movement that emerged in the late 60s and continued into the 70s. The new Hollywood era, by the way, saw the rise of independent filmmakers like Francis Ford Coppola, William Friedkin, Brian De Palma, and Scorsese, who challenged conventional storytelling techniques and societal norms. How about you, Clay?
I never fell in love with Scorsese like you did, Ken, nor did I like this film one bit when I first saw it a few years ago. While my opinion of it went up a little bit in seeing it a second time for this podcast, I still don't think much of this movie. One of the more interesting real-world connections Taxi Driver has is its controversial role in John Hinckley's motive in trying to assassinate then-President Ronald Reagan in 1981. Taxi Driver formed part of the delusional fantasy of Hinckley's assassination attempt, an act for which he was found not guilty by reason of insanity. Hinckley stated that his actions were an attempt to impress actress Jodie Foster, on whom Hinckley was fixated. Hinckley's attorney concluded his defense by playing the movie for the jury. Let's listen to a short clip from the official trailer of Taxi Driver.
This city here is like an open sewer, you know? It's full of filth and scum.
I think I know what you mean, Travis.
The taxi driver is looking for a target. Getting ready. Getting organized. Preparing himself for the only moment in his life that will ever mean anything.
That taxi driver's been staring at us.
You talking to me? You talking to me?
I don't know who's weirder, you or me.
You talking to me?
Although two wildly different films, one of the things that Taxi Driver shares with Rocky is the depiction of the urban decay which plagued American cities during the 1970s. Rocky opens with a montage of downtown Philadelphia's urban blight. Ironically, the city at the center of America's bicentennial and the city where the Declaration of Independence was signed in 1776. Taxi Driver does the same in its opening, including this excerpt from Travis Bickle's diary.
All the animals come out at night. Whores, skunk pussies, buggers, queens, fairies, dopers, junkies. Someday a real rain will come and wash all the scum off the streets.
The real rain alludes to Travis himself in his delusional and vigilante attempt to rid the streets of the scum that pervaded Times Square, Manhattan, in the 1970s. I remember visiting Times Square around this time when I was a kid, and I was genuinely terrified. And Scorsese captured that grit and grime perfectly. Times Square has since been transformed into a tourist trap mecca. For me, almost as terrifying today as it was in the 70s.
I'd argue that the whole damn city of New York is one terrifying place, Ken. But don't get me started on that subject.
All right.
Taxi Driver serves as a commentary on the psychological toll of war and the alienation experienced by returning Vietnam veterans in 1970s America. Travis Bickle grapples with severe PTSD and struggles to reintegrate into civilian life. His experiences in the war have left him emotionally scarred and delusional, leading to a deep sense of isolation and detachment from society. Travis's descent into madness and obsession with vigilantism can be interpreted as a manifestation of his trauma and disillusionment with the world around him.
One of the most commercially successful and critically acclaimed movies of 1976 was the satirical drama Network, written by Paddy Chayefsky and directed by Sidney Lumet. Chayefsky was a highly acclaimed American playwright, screenwriter, and novelist known for his incisive wit and biting social commentary. His screenplay for Network earned him one of three Academy Awards in his career for writing. Network is about a fictional television network, the Union Broadcasting System, or UBS, situated in the film as the fourth television network after NBC, CBS, and ABC, and its struggle with its poor ratings. The story focuses on Howard Beale, a veteran news anchor who, after being fired, becomes a prophet-like figure on television, urging viewers to express their anger and frustration. I know this was your first time seeing this, but what were your general impressions?
I thought it was a pretty great film.
Good.
A little far-fetched at times, but the far-fetchedness serves a purpose, so I'm going to let that slide. Chayefsky was supposedly inspired to write Network after hearing about the 1974 story of television news reporter Christine Chubbuck, who committed the first on-screen suicide in television history. Chayefsky used the idea of a live TV death as the film's terminating focal point, later saying in an interview, quote, "Television will do anything for a rating. Anything." End quote. He also believed America's general anger about the state of the nation and world was being broadcast in everything from sitcoms to news reports. Keep in mind, television by 1976 had become the most dominant means of electronic communication in the world, especially the United States. An entire generation had passed since television's creation in the late 1940s and early 50s.
And I was absolutely one of those late baby boomers that was weaned on television in my youth. I was 16 in 76, and television was as central to my existence as cell phones and social media are to the Gen Zers and millennials of today. As a kid, I wasn't obviously cognizant of television's influence on me or society, but seeing this film several times through the last several years forced me to ponder television's influence on me and the world. It showcased the intersection of media, politics, and the cult of personality in a way that not only was on target for the 1970s, but more importantly, it was prescient about how television would evolve to the point of where we are today, with TV personalities becoming demigod world leaders. And we'll get more into that in a little bit, but let's first hear a clip from the film's official trailer.
I'm going to blow my brains out right on this program a week from today.
What the hell's going on?
Howard Beale went up there last night and said what every American feels, that he's tired of all the bull.
For sakes, Diana, we're talking about putting a manifestly irresponsible man on national television.
I want a show developed based on the activities of a terrorist group.
I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
There's a bunch of themes running through Network that we could talk about for hours, but let's limit it to two. The influence of television as a force of demagoguery and journalistic integrity, which is going to be another theme we'll be discussing in the last film we're talking about, All the President's Men. Unlike the plethora of news organizations we have today, back in 1976, there were only three basic options for television viewers to get their national news. CBS, NBC, and ABC. And despite the hyperbolized version of TV news seen in the fictional Network of the movie, those three networks provided a somewhat accurate depiction of the major news stories and, for the most part, avoided heavy-handed bias reporting. However, when UBS, the fictional network in the movie, begins to lose rating share and therefore revenue and shareholder return on investment, a crass media executive, played by Faye Dunaway, crosses an ethical line to exploit the mental illness of the network's lead anchor, whose maniacal on-air rantings become a rating sensation. Once again, this is a hyperbolized reimagining of things, but there was definitely a growing trend of prioritizing entertainment value over journalistic integrity during the 1970s. The bottom line was profits, any way you can get it.
In fact, there's a line in the movie that underscores that last point that you made perfectly. As some of the TV executives are debating the issue of exploiting Howard Beale, one executive says to the group, quote, "All I know is this violates every canon of respectable broadcasting." To which another executive replies, quote, "We're not a respectable network. We're a whorehouse network, and we have to take whatever we can get," unquote. What's interesting about this point of journalistic integrity is that the next movie we're going to discuss, All the President's Men, is all about journalistic integrity. However, in that film, it's the print media that toes the line of journalistic integrity. The power of Network and Paddy Chayefsky's writing is how it exposes television journalism as nothing more than dumbed-down populist schlock catering to the lowest common denominator in an effort to make a few media oligarchs wealthier. However, after watching this movie again, what struck me more than anything was how it predicted the rise of TV commentators and future U.S. presidents as Howard Beale-like demigods. Howard Beale's "I'm mad as hell" rantings capitalized on a growing citizen rage happening in America in the mid-1970s. First of all, America had lost the Vietnam War, which it never loses wars. The president resigned in scandal. Minorities and women were threatening white people, especially white men's long-held dominance. I argue that citizen rage never subsided and only worsened through the years to the point of a reality TV star and real estate shyster who capitalized on that rage and ended up in the White House.
I assume you're talking about our God and Savior, Donald J. Trump?
Well, I wouldn't go that far, Cliff, but yes, I do happen to be referring to Donald Trump.
Well, there are definitely similarities between the character of Bill and the real-life Donald Trump. Bill and Trump captivated audiences with their unfiltered and often controversial rhetoric. Trump's bombastic speeches and unorthodox communication style resonated with a segment of the American electorate disillusioned with traditional politics and hungry for change. Bill and Trump leveraged the power of the media to amplify their messages and cultivate a devoted following. Bill and Trump tapped into populist sentiments and capitalized on widespread dissatisfaction with the status quo. Bill's rallying cry for viewers to express their anger and frustration resonated with a public disillusioned with political corruption and corporate greed. Similarly, Trump's anti-establishment rhetoric and promises to, quote, "drain the swamp," unquote, appealed to voters who felt marginalized by mainstream politicians and left behind by globalization and technological change. There is one difference, though, I would argue, between Bill and Trump.
And that is?
Bill is capitalizing on angry Americans, and he's trying to stoke that anger. I would argue that Trump is going way past anger. He's trying to stoke the rage in everybody, and he wants hate. And he doesn't care if violence comes after the hate.
Yeah. As noted earlier, the last film we're going to discuss is about one of American history's greatest journalistic stories and the definitive movie about why freedom of the press remains one of America's most vital democratic attributes. All the President's Men was written by William Goldman and directed by Alan Pakula. It was based on the 1974 nonfiction book of the same name written by Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward, the two rookie Washington Post journalists who broke the story of Watergate leading to the eventual resignation of President Nixon in 1974. Unlike the book, the film covers only the first 7 months of the Watergate scandal, from the time of the break-in to Nixon's second inauguration in January of 1973. Robert Redford co-produced and starred as Bob Woodward in the film, and Dustin Hoffman played Carl Bernstein.
By way of super quick background, five men were arrested for breaking into the offices of the Democratic National Committee located in the Watergate building in 1972. The men were quickly associated with President Nixon's re-election campaign. What followed from this third-rate burglary attempt was a three-year journey of multiple investigations, congressional hearings, and court challenges, culminating in the resignation of President Richard Nixon, the only U.S. president ever to resign. Nixon and his senior advisors operated on the warped presumption that the re-election of the president and the continuation of his policies were essential to the preservation of government during the turbulent days of the early 1970s. All the President's Men is regarded as one of the best American movies of all time, ranking number 77 on the American Film Institute's top 100 films. And it's absolutely regarded as one of the best films about journalistic reporting. Let's listen to a short clip from the film's official trailer.
They stumbled into Leeds.
Certainly, it comes as no surprise to you that Howard was with the CIA.
No surprise at all.
They tripped over clues.
We'd like to see all the material requested by the White House.
This whole thing is a cover-up. It's right on our nose.
And piece by piece, they solve the greatest detective story in American history. At times, it looked as if it might cost them their jobs, perhaps even their lives.
It's really important to understand the timeline of events in this story and the film itself. The break-in happened in the summer of 72, resulting in the first printed story in the Washington Post. Woodward and Bernstein doggedly pursued the story over the next couple of years. Concurrently, the FBI and Congress led their own investigation over that time. The U.S. Senate committee held 3 months of Watergate hearings in the summer of 73, and it became one of the most watched live events in the history of television up to that point. Soon after, Nixon was forced to give up his secretly recorded audio tapes to Congress, and the smoking gun of Nixon's own voice assured his demise. Knowing impeachment and probable conviction was imminent, Nixon resigned in the summer of 74. The book of All the President's Men was published only 3 months before Nixon's resignation. It became the fastest-selling nonfiction hardcover book in U.S. history. Less than 2 years later, the film version was released and went on to become the fifth highest-grossing movie of 76. And in the opinion of no less an authority than Ronald Reagan himself, ensured then-President Gerald Ford's defeat at the hands of Jimmy Carter in the 1976 election. So truly, this story and film had profound historical implications for the United States and the world. And then you got to give so much credit to those two rookie reporters and their bosses for never giving up in the pursuit of truth, which is really what good news reporting is supposed to be about.
Indeed. Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward and their editors at the Washington Post worked their asses off to give the American people an accurate account of what was going on in Nixon's White House. They were the concept of journalistic integrity personified. Truth was what was most important to them. And when I say truth, I mean the real thing, what actually happened, not what someone believed to have happened or what someone wanted to have happened. In other words, the facts and nothing but them. All the President's Men was a victory lap for American journalism, the triumphant flip side to network's self-loathing take on the media and its premise that the news had to be sensationalized or people wouldn't watch it. Television was clearly the most prevalent mass medium in the United States around this time, and its influence on society, as we heard in our discussion on the movie Network, was omnipresent. The three major networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, still controlled the airwaves. However, cable television was very slowly eroding network dominance, especially in more rural areas. The number one year-ending show of 1976 was Happy Days, which we profiled in our 1974 episode.
The success of Happy Days spawned several spinoffs. And I know Joni and Chachi was your favorite spinoff.
Oh my God, the worst, not only the worst spinoff in television history, just the worst television program in television history.
Well, the very first spinoff of Happy Days series was Laverne and Shirley, and that debuted in 1976. Laverne and Shirley starred Penny Marshall and Cindy Williams as Laverne DeFazio and Shirley Feeney, two friends and roommates who work as bottle cappers in the fictitious Schatz Brewery in Milwaukee, Wisconsin during the late 1950s. Laverne and Shirley were introduced during Happy Days' third season in early 1976, and they quickly became fan favorites, leading to the development of their own spin-off series, Laverne and Shirley, later that year. The show also featured the comedy duo of Lenny and Squiggy, played by Michael McKean and David Lander, perhaps the best sidekick duo in television history. Don't you think, Cliff?
They're definitely up there, Ken. McKean and Lander created their characters as part of their comedy improv routine when they were both students at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. The series debuted to strong ratings and maintained a high level of viewership throughout its eight-season run from 1976 to 1983. Let's listen to a short promotional clip from the show's premiere season featuring the Fonz from Happy Days, played by Henry Winkler.
Hey, listen up. I got news for you. Tuesday night, right after Happy Days, you're invited to meet Laverne and Shirley.
That's us. I'm Shirley. This is Laverne.
Of course that's us. Who'd you think they think we were, Doris Day and Sandra Dee?
Don't start, Laverne. We're on national television.
Whoa! Laverne and Shirley. I'll be there too, because I'm their guest star. Now listen, I want you to watch because they're very close friends of mine. How close? Girl.
I love how the Fonz only has to snap his fingers to get Laverne and Shirley to kiss him. Yeah. I usually have to take my pants off to get that kind of attention from women, Ken.
Oh, Cliff.
Although Laverne and Shirley was set during the late 50s and early 60s, the show provided an interesting and entertaining spin on the second wave feminist movement of the 1970s. They were two blue-collar women working in a Milwaukee factory. This challenged traditional television portrayals that often relegated women to domestic roles. Laverne and Shirley showcased female independence and their pursuit of careers outside the home, reflecting the growing number of women entering the workforce during this period.
I was a big fan of Laverne and Shirley back then. They came off kind of like a Lucy and Ethel from the I Love Lucy show. They were wacky and they would seemingly do anything for a laugh, especially physical humor. They demonstrated the viability of female-centric comedy and they paved the way for future sitcoms centered around female relationships like Golden Girls or Designing Women or One Day at a Time. The show was set in a blue-collar, working-class neighborhood, often tackling financial struggles and job security concerns. Issues very much relevant during the economic anxieties of the late 70s and early 80s. The show's blue-collar appeal clearly resonated with audiences and would go on to later influence sitcoms like Good Times, Roseanne, and Taxi.
In addition, Laverne and Shirley looked like average American women. They had a plain beauty to them. Gary Marshall, show producer and father of Penny Marshall, who played Laverne, explained, quote, "The public was dying for somebody who didn't look like Mary Tyler Moore or all the pretty girls on TV. They wanted somebody who looked like a regular person. And these two looked and talked like regular people," end quote.
Another show that debuted in 1976 definitely did not take the regular female look approach, and that was Charlie's Angels. The show followed the crime-fighting adventures of three women working at a private detective agency in Los Angeles, California. There were a bunch of casting changes over the course of the show's five seasons, but the debut season originally starred Kate Jackson, Farrah Fawcett Majors, and Jacqueline Smith in the leading roles. John Forsythe provided the voice of their boss, the unseen Charlie Townsend, who directed the crime-fighting operations of the Angels over a speakerphone. The show was a top 10 hit in the Nielsen ratings for its first two seasons, but by the fifth season, the show fell out of the top 30 and was subsequently canceled. Charlie's Angels was immediately labeled Jiggle TV, programs that featured attractive actresses in revealing clothing, attracting viewers with suggestive and titillating content.
Even Farrah Fawcett knew the reason for the show's success, saying once in an interview, quote, "When the show was number three, I figured it was our acting. When it got to be number one, I decided it could only be because none of us wears a bra," end quote.
Yeah, thus the Jiggle TV, because, you know, those lawless women with protruding nipples was a very encouraged Jiggle TV.
You know, I loved this series when I was a little kid. I couldn't figure out which woman I was in love with more. But rewatching it for this podcast, it left a lot to be desired, Ken. I mean, there were some jiggles, but
let's be honest, Cliff. This show was downright awful. Jacqueline Smith, the only cast member to be on all five seasons, argued differently, however, claiming, quote, "It was groundbreaking. It was about three emotionally and financially independent women. Critics said that as actresses, we were sexually exploited, but it was a nursery rhyme," unquote. Well, Jacqueline, why don't you check out this snippet from the first season?
Okay, girls, strip down to your birthday suits.
In front of him?
Tell the warden we hit the jackpot this time.
That's not the kind of nursery rhymes I was brought up on, though I wish I had been. Despite provocative scenes like the one we just heard, the show did provide a platform for female empowerment in a male-dominated genre, showcasing women in action-packed roles and challenging traditional gender roles in television.
There were two feature films created in the early 2000s using the premise of the Charlie's Angels TV show. However, it's really interesting to note several differences in how both properties addressed feminist ideas. Unlike the TV series, which emphasized the angels' physical appearance over their abilities, the films portrayed them as competent professionals and formidable fighters who were not defined solely by their looks. The films also embraced a more playful, tongue-in-cheek tone, often poking fun at the conventions of action movies while undermining the male gaze. Lastly, the film's adaptations of Charlie's Angels featured a more diverse and inclusive cast, reflecting a broader representation of women in terms of race and ethnicity, including Lucy Liu and Cameron Diaz.
The 21st century Angels may not have been as jiggly as the 70s Angels, but there's no denying the original Charlie's Angels encouraged women to embrace their sexuality and traditionally feminine traits as a means to reclaim their power. Showing women saving the day while still balancing in heels and seducing onlookers was, for many at the time, the height of progress.
Hey, we need to give a quick shout out to one of my favorite TV debuts from 1976. The Muppet Show, created by Jim Henson, quickly became a beloved television series known for its unique blend of humor, music, and puppetry. Each episode followed a variety show format with guest stars from the worlds of entertainment, music, and comedy joining the Muppets in sketches, musical performances, and comedic bits. The show's infectious energy and irreverent humor appealed to both children and adults, transcending demographics and earning it a very dedicated fan base, including myself. The show's
And me.
Good. The show's cultural impact extended beyond television, with the Muppets becoming iconic figures in their own right, appearing in feature films, specials, merchandise, and theme park attractions.
Moreover, The Muppet Show was notable for its diverse cast of characters and its inclusive approach to humor and storytelling. Through its witty satire and playful irreverence, the show had an intelligence to it, and it promoted themes of friendship, diversity, and acceptance. The Muppets' ability to address complex topics in a lighthearted and accessible manner endeared them to audiences and cemented their status as cultural icons. Let's move over to the music of 1976. The music industry was undergoing notable shifts and facing both challenges and innovations. The mid-1970s marked the continued dominance of rock music enjoying widespread popularity, and you're going to hear that for the most part in the songs we've selected. However, the industry was diversifying with the emergence of new genres such as disco, punk rock, and funk gaining momentum. In terms of technology, vinyl records remained the primary medium for album releases. However, the introduction of cassette tapes and 8-track tapes offer new options for music consumption.
The music itself of 1976 was epic. In fact, I was thinking about this the other day, Cliff. Yeah. If I had to be stranded on a desert island and I could listen to only 1 year of music for the rest of my desert stranded life, I would absolutely pick 1976.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'll have to give that some thought.
Yeah, music for me that year was my escape from the misery of my life at that time. My parents had just gotten divorced, my face was one gigantic zit, and I pretty much hated my entire high school experience. But music got me through it all, and I'm so excited to feature much of that music with you and our audience. But not this song, which happened to be the number one year-ending song in 1976, Tonight's the Night by Rod Stewart.
Tonight's the night.
God damn, of all the incredible music released in 1976, this sappy ode to throwing down cheesy pickup lines and getting your lover to spread her wings so you can come inside was just the worst representation of the quality tunes that came out in 76. So here's what we're going to do, Cliff. We have 9 songs or albums to feature. We're only going to give a maximum of 2 minutes for each song. That's 60 seconds for you and 60 seconds for me. Are you ready?
All right. Song number 1, Hotel California by the Eagles. It's a long fucker.
Oh, it is long.
Clocking in at 6 minutes and 30 seconds. You know me, Ken. I love epic things. Epic books, epic movies, epic songs, etc. So I played the shit out of Hotel California when I was a young teenager. In my adult opinion, it's not one of their better songs, which means you probably loved it.
Well, I did love it, but I gotta be honest. I have also found that the song does not hold up well into my later years. The song is an interesting mix of rock and Mexican reggae, which is actually the term used by Don Henley to describe the song. It tells a compelling story about American decadence and excess, too much money, drugs, and self-destruction, which sets up the 1980s decade perfectly. Listening to this song and album after 48 years brings back memories, but not sure the entire album holds up as much as I remembered back in 76. The standout tracks for me after 48 years, Try and Love Again, and The Last Resort.
Right, the Last Resort is just
beautiful.
They might be the Eagles.
Their best.
Yeah.
Great American band, but I now argue this was not their creative peak.
Next up is a song that I argue needs no introduction because its actual introduction is so recognizable and so fucking good. The song is American Girl by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, the closing track to their eponymous debut album. Who wouldn't fall in love with those opening electric guitar chords played on top of another softer electric guitar while those guitars really start strumming and the bass all of a sudden comes in and takes lead? And oh my God, Ken, I got chills just talking about it.
I have chills as well, Cliff.
When she was an American girl.
American Girl became one of Petty's most popular songs and a staple of classic rock. It has been consistently rated as his best song, more than a classic rock standard. It's practically part of the American literary canon.
Shockingly, this song never even charted back then, and the highest spot it ever achieved was number 40 in the UK. What the hell? But for those true rockers like myself back in 1976, I knew after hearing this song and album back then that Tom Petty was destined for greatness. You know, and back then, the song had a punkish, Elvis Costello-like edge to it, and many critics and DJs labeled Petty a punk rocker. But the entire album is as diverse as the entire 70s sound. This song in particular, with its Bo Diddley backbeat shuffle and story about how the American dream may not always be what it's cracked up to be, is a 70s standout. Although it would take 3 albums in total before the Heartbreakers hit it big, this was the song and album that established Tom Petty and his incredible band as truly one of the greatest bands in rock history.
The Pretender by Jackson Browne is the title track to his 4th studio album and is arguably one of his greatest contributions to American music, as the song is simply beautiful, both musically and lyrically. The opening 2 verses see the song's narrator determined to settle down and work a job every day, an act that has become basically a religion in this country, which might be why he closes the 2nd verse with 2 amens. But he struggles to make sense of this life, and perhaps all life, as he finds himself caught between the longing for love and the routine of getting enough money to get by. Later in the song, he is determined to have both love and money, and he dreams of coming home and making love to the girl of his dreams, and so the religion of work makes room for the spirituality of love. One of my favorite lines, and probably the saddest uttered over the course of the song, "Are you there? Say a prayer for the pretender, who started out so young and strong, only to surrender.
So after compiling and listening to the playlist that I made for 76, which everyone can access by way of our website, kenandcliff.com, I have come to the conclusion that The Pretender by Jackson Browne is in fact the best song released in 1976. Browne paints a portrait of America in its bicentennial year that's not all rosy and upbeat, but there is so much honesty and vivid imagery in the lyrics, you can't help but get swept up in its beauty and scope. This song has it all. Sweeping composition, poignant and contemplative lyrics, emotive vocals, flawless musicianship. The song also contains one of my favorite lines of all time, and will fill in the missing colors in each other's paint-by-numbers dreams. Love that line. There are a ton of great songs from 76, but none as perfect in every way as this one. And if you're curious, Cliff, it's number 11 in my top 25 songs of all time. Cliff, I know you would have never chosen this next album, but as an avid R&B lover, I had to acknowledge at least one R&B standout from 1976, and that, for me, and a lot of people, is Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life album. I was shocked to find out that Stevie Wonder was seriously considering retiring from music before recording this album. But fortunately, Motown gave him 100% creative control, and he delivered what many considered to be his magnum opus. It's absolutely the last great studio album made by Wonder, which kind of bums me out that he was never able to achieve that degree of creativity and greatness again. But I guess you can say that about a lot of artists.
Yes, you can.
In all honesty, it would have been an A-plus perfect album if it was just a single album, but Wonder chose to release it as a double record with 21 tracks, some of which were career-defining songs, like Sir Duke, I Wish, and my personal favorite, As. Around the sun, the earth, the sea, revolving, and the rosebuds know the bloom in early May. Despite a couple musical missteps, this is a brilliant record. It showcases Wonder's undeniable versatility and innovation, blending elements of soul, funk, jazz, and pop to create a rich tapestry of sound. Lyrically, the album encompasses a bunch of things, including love and relationships, spirituality and faith, and a powerful social commentary about the Black experience. Each song on the album is a testament to Wonder's musical genius and his ability to push boundaries. What's next, Cliff?
Night Moves by Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band, the title track to their ninth studio album. Working on a night move, trying to make some front page driving news. Like Tom Petty's American Girl, the intro to this song is instantly recognizable, though much simpler in scope, just Seger doing a hitch step strum on an acoustic guitar. The opening verse is also a classic, as Seger paints a minimalist picture of the song's two protagonists. She was a black-haired beauty with big dark eyes and points of her own, sitting way up high, way up firm and high, and I bet you, probably jiggling. Seger wrote the song as a coming-of-age tale about adolescent love and the adult memory of it, and the theme is pretty much about sex, sex, and more sex, with a little reflection and nostalgia thrown in. The term night moves is both a euphemism for getting some and for how quickly time flies. It was based on Seger's teenage love affair, which he experienced in the early 1960s. It took Seger over 6 months to write the song, and I can see why, as it is a near-perfect gem, particularly lyrically. Every verse is quotable. The song ends with Seger shouting out, "Lord, I remember! Lord, I remember!" And you know he in fact does, because don't we all still remember those early loves?
Absolutely, Cliff. I was never a big fan of this next song and group, Dancing Queen by the Swedish group ABBA, but there is absolutely no denying the historical impact this song and group has had on global pop culture. Remarkably, this was ABBA's only number one hit in the United States, but even more remarkably, this song hit number one in 17 other countries, including even the Soviet Union. True story. There really isn't much to say about this song. It's one of the disco era's defining songs. It's got an infectious hook with a fun sing-along chorus that has propelled many a coked-up partygoer on the dance floor, but ABBA was just never my cup of pop music tea.
I am also not a big fan of ABBA or Dancing Queen. I know I'm going to get a lot of heat from some of the kids back home for saying so, but it's the truth. But then again, I was never a fan of disco in general. But I'm quite surprised you're not a fan of this song, Ken. I mean, this thing is infectious with a capital fex. I was walking my dog the other day listening to this, and I had to stop so I could twirl around a couple times. I mean, that's how danceable this song is. I mean, it's so infectious, right?
Oh, it is an infectious song.
We need
sure.
to acknowledge that this song has become a major anthem in the LGBTQ community. The term queen has historically been used within gay culture, affectionately referring to flamboyant or effeminate gay men.
Listen, I'm not going to deny the infectious quality of the song. And I love big harmony groups, but there was something about ABBA that just never grabbed me. This next song and group was somewhat of a musical anomaly back in 76. Female rockers were few and far between in the 70s. The all-female group The Runaways, featuring Joan Jett, appeared in 1975, but they never really made a big commercial impact. Women generally played supporting roles like Grace Slick in Jefferson Airplane or Nixon McVie in Fleetwood Mac, but in 1976, a pair of sisters released an album which rocked as hard as any other album at that time. The group was Heart, the album was Dreamboat Annie, and this rock classic, Crazy on You, proved women could rock as hard as any guy. Ann Wilson's powerful vocals and Nancy Wilson's guitar skills defied conventional notions of women's roles in rock bands. I love this song. It blended acoustic and electric guitars so effectively, and when you add Ann Wilson's Robert Plant-like voice into the mix, it was a power rock force.
Crazy on You also has a very distinctive opening, with Nancy Wilson picking around on an acoustic guitar. The groove of her picking suggests that this isn't going to be some chill folk song, but something harder, faster, groovier. But then it slows down for a few seconds, and what we hear next sounds like something straight from a spaghetti western movie, where two gunfighters wait for the other to throw down. And throw down they do, because next thing you know, Nancy Wilson starts strumming that acoustic guitar like her life depends on it, and eventually gets joined by electric guitar, bass, and drums, and that something harder, faster, and groovier than you suspected finally arrives. During the verses, Ann Wilson's voice is restrained, but not so during the choruses. She wails out her intention to go crazy on you like a woman possessed, and every able-bodied straight male listening can't help but wish they were the man she's about to sexually devour. I get a Woody just talking about it, Ken.
Well, your points are sitting way up high right now, Cliff. We're going to end our discussion on the music of 1976 with two songs from two bands that, quite honestly, I was not a fan of back then, but there is no denying the impact both bands had on popular music history. One was from the US and the other was from the UK, and both groups launched their cannon shot in 1976, establishing punk music as a dominant force for the next decade and beyond. The Ramones were first out of the gate with their song Blitzkrieg Bop. The Ramones were a New York City band that had been around since 1974. Blitzkrieg Bop pretty much defined the punk rock sound of the 70s with its raw energy, simple chord progressions, and fast-paced tempo. The song's minimalist structure and catchy, "Hey, ho, let's go," that chant became emblematic of the punk movement and was featured in a ton of sports arenas because it's just one of those crowd-rousing little hooks.
The other punk band that year was the Sex Pistols with their song Anarchy in the UK. Anarchy in the UK is number 56 on Rolling Stone magazine's list of the 500 greatest songs of all time, and is included in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's 500 songs that shaped rock and roll. While I completely disagree with Rolling Stone,
and as I do as well,
okay, I wouldn't put it anywhere near the top 500 greatest songs of all time. I do think that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame got it right, as Anarchy in the UK was basically the song that launched 1,000 bands, maybe more. Its aggressive, anti-establishment lyrics and raw, high-energy sound captured the frustration and disillusionment of a generation, laying the groundwork for the punk ethos. It's time to reveal our personal favorite release from 1976. I'll go first. I've been beating myself up since our 1977 show that I didn't choose Warren Zevon's third album, Excitable Boy, as my personal favorite for that year. I had no idea the album came out in 77, so I went with something else. So to make it up to Zevon, who is one of my all-time favorite singer-songwriters, I chose the opening track from his second album, Frank and Jesse James, as one of my two personal favorites for 76.
Keep on riding, riding, riding. Frank and Jesse James. Keep on riding, riding, riding.
Since he was shot in the back and killed in 1882, there has emerged a wide body of songs that celebrate or allude to the infamous gunman. And in my opinion, Frank and Jesse James is one of the best of them. It also displays Zevon's wonderful gift for storytelling in music. My other personal favorite from 76 is the band Kiss's ballad, Beth, which features drummer Peter Criss on lead vocals.
Beth, I hear you calling.
I fell in love with the band Kiss before I was even old enough to go to school, because my cousins Bud and Dale had Kiss dolls that they always let me play with. Peter Criss, with his cat makeup, was always my favorite member of the band, and Beth is my favorite song by Kiss. How about you, Ken?
So as I've revealed, 1976 was a mega important year for me, and trying to select one or two things was just next to impossible. So instead, I've selected eight songs and albums that remain favorites of mine to this day, and I'm going to be super quick about this. Here we go. The debut album from Boston. Boz Scaggs, Low Down. One of my all-time favorite bands, Orleans. Billy Joel's Turnstiles album.
They blew the bronze away. Sank my heaven, now to see.
Taken It to the Streets by the Doobie Brothers. The entire album, The Royal Scam by Steely Dan. David Bowie's Golden Years.
Don't let me hear you say life's taking you nowhere.
And finally, and absolutely, the most funky song of 1976, and I gotta get up here, Cliff, Car Wash by Rolls Royce. Cliff, but I gotta get up.
No, it's Jiggle TV. It's Jiggle TV. Well, that does it for this show. If anyone's interested to learn more about the stuff featured in this episode, the films, music, and TV discussed, please visit our website, kenandcliff.com. You'll find links to additional reading, Spotify song list, Letterboxd list, and an opportunity to contact us about what you like and don't like about the show.
Next week, we'll be covering the year 2006. We'll discuss the films Borat, Children of Men, and Little Miss Sunshine. It was a thin year for TV debuts, so we'll only be discussing one show, but it's a good one, 30 Rock. And for music, we'll hear songs from Beyonce, Gnarls Barkley, Amy Winehouse, and Daniel Powder. You ever hear of Danny Powder, Cliff? He had that big hit, Bad Day.
Yeah, I've heard it.
Yeah.
It blows.
Can't wait to talk about that.
Please share your view mirror with Ken and Cliff, with your friends and family, Rocky Balboa, Travis Bickle, Howard Bill, Carl Bernstein, and Bob Woodward. You can always find us on kenandcliff.com and drop us a message about what you like and don't like. Join us next time on Your View Mirror with Ken and Cliff.